Hi, this is Ilkar Cassidy with Passive House Accelerator, and thanks for tuning in to the special bonus episode of the Passive House podcast recorded at Building Energy Boston 2024. And a big thank you to New Energy Works High Performance Enclosure, Timber Framing, and Wood-Based Building Materials for their support of the series. Welcome to the podcast, Anna Dimio. I'm really happy that you took the time to speak with me because I feel like your perspective coming from the climate tech side is quite different than what I've covered so far. But first, can you introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit more about what you do and your background?
Sure. Good to be here. So I have spent a couple decades now around climate tech. I have a background in engineering. I started off in telecom back in the 90s when that industry was going through deregulation and there was disruptive business models and technology that all feels very familiar with what's going on in energy now. Moved on from there, started a company around climate tech, doing smart load management of distributed energy resources, that's storage, solar, and then the ability to manage loads, be it in a home or a building. So you could talk about that as a microgrid or, spoiler alert, as a virtual power plant. Grew that company up, was acquired, moved on to do work with a company in vehicle to grid. And most recently, I am working as a strategic and technical advisor for companies large and small that are trying to figure out climate tech. The company I started was founded based on my PhD work doing a microgrid for an island off the coast of Maine where we modeled tidal solar storage and wind, but really the novel part was this idea of revenue grade energy monitoring and load control. So started Race Point out of that. I grew that company up and have a number of patents, co-patents, around this climate tech space of smart electrical, smart devices to monitor and manage power, as well as things around electric vehicles.
Awesome. At this conference, we're looking at climate resilience from a lot of different perspectives. And I feel like each session that I have attended was basically saying we each do our own part, but we also have to step back, look at the bigger picture, and also really understand what everyone else is doing in terms of climate resilience. So I would like to hear from you, from your perspective, from the climate tech perspective, what does climate resilience mean for you?
Ooh. That's a big question. Let me take a crack at it. So early days of teaching, doing research around climate change, it was about mitigation and resiliency, or the two, mitigation, resiliency, adaptation and resiliency. We've gotten to a point now where mitigation is much harder. It's really about adaptation and resiliency. And so for me in my world, what that looks like is When you think about the formula to address in the climate tech world, you have three big buckets. You have the utility grid, you have mobility, so transportation, and then you have the built environment, homes and building, which is really the focus of this conference. Those three combined for the U.S. market make up close to 70% of greenhouse gas emissions. And so the solutions come at the innovation of climate tech comes at the center of those three overlapping circles. And so when I think about the resiliency piece, from my perspective, is how do we make sure, first and foremost, that you keep the lights on, right? Because this is a safety and security, it's an economics, and what's interesting is that what it means to keep the lights on, that motivator. So I think about the three motivators, I always talk about the three E's, which is energy resilience, economics, and environmental stewardship. And we're really talking, you're asking me about the energy resilience piece. And those three drivers are true of consumers, they're true of business owners, they're true of utilities, right? They all have the same goal, and it's just how do we get there? And so from my take is that the utility grid was built up over 100 years ago in a generation following demand model, which means that all of us in our homes and businesses use power whenever we want. And folks at the utility are ramping up and down generation to follow that. But as we move to decarbonize the grid, what that means is that you have more solar and wind. The fastest growing sector of new utility generation is solar and wind. And that is not what we call dispatchable. That's dependent on Mother Nature, right? So we're flipping this model. So it's really a paradigm shift where we're flipping this model of generation following demand to demand following generation, right? And so as far as I'm a business owner or a homeowner in, and I want to make sure that the lights stay on, but I don't want to sit there and, you know, turn on and off things all day long. We still want to live our lives, right? So resiliency in climate tech is as we see this paradigm shift, and another paradigm shift that's happening is in transportation, mobility. We're going to electric vehicles, whether whether you think we are or not, it's happening. And those two, both the utility grid and transportation, are two really foundational industries to our way of life. And they haven't really changed in 100 years. And both really affect what happens in our home and how we get from our home to our business, right? So you can't disconnect these. And so the good news, some good news, is that the tech exists to make all of this work. It really is about the policies and the economics and the models to drive it. So the tech is the easy part. And I think I went off on a tangent and probably didn't answer your question.
No, this is great. Because I also want to know a little bit more about virtual power plants, because that's something that you're going to present about.
Yes, yes. So virtual power plants, which is just a very cool name, and it's gotten a lot of traction as of late. Something that, you know, when you're in an echo chamber, we've been talking about virtual power plants for almost two decades, but now it's the hot topic of the day. So I'm very happy that we're talking about VPPs here. So the idea, the traditional model of the power plant, is that you have large power generators, be it natural gas or coal or nuclear or whatever. That power is stepped up to very high voltages, sent very long distances to our communities, stepped down, and then distributed. That model has served us well for 100 years. It's no longer serving us well, both because of aging infrastructure, because of the sources of that power, and because we're just using so much of it now, right? And especially as we think about electrifying everything, electrifying heating and cooling, electrifying our transportation, this is just a whole new level of need. And so what a virtual power plant is the idea is that you have all of these distributed resources, and we call them distributed energy resources, so DER or DERs. And that can look like a battery in your home. It can look like a battery in your electric car. It can look like solar panels on your roof. It can look like a big solar field put out by a utility. And so those are somewhat intuitive, right? Those are all sources. But it can also look like a number of interesting, I'm putting my fingers in quotes, of smart devices in our homes and buildings. So this is smart thermostats, hot water heaters, HVAC, so heating and cooling, and more. And so by managing load, so maybe we're not heating our water at 5 o'clock at night when everybody comes home from work and people are cooking dinner and watching television and doing laundry and charging their vehicles, and there's this huge spike. Whereas if we can heat our water or wash our dishes or charge our car at 11 o'clock at night when there's all this excess wind, but no one's using the power, right? It's not rocket science. It's just a matter of building that intelligence in. So back to virtual power plant. The idea is that you take a number of these distributed energy resources, DERs, you aggregate them together, and when you need a bunch of power, rather than firing up that coal plant, what you do is you use this these number of distributed energy resources to either shed load or add power back to the grid instead of ramping up and down a traditional generator.
And you also mentioned something about negative DERs, correct?
Yes.
What is that?
Yeah, so when you think about power plants or batteries or solar, the unit of power is a kilowatt or a megawatt or a gigawatt. Amory Levins coined this idea of a negawatt, which is you have the same effect of putting power on the grid as taking demand off the grid. And so when I say demand, really simple, is I turn on my lights and that causes somewhere someone to have to feed me more power, right? So somewhere power is being generated to power that light. So if I turn off that light, then that power plant doesn't need as much, right? So that's a negawatt. It's a simple equation. I can either put power on or I can take power off.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I called it negative DIRS, but it's actually megawatts.
Yeah.
I like that.
Not my term. But DIRS, distributed energy resources, can go both ways. It can be a load that you turn off or on, or a power source like a battery. And just to be clear, so I've been giving you the example of that in the residential communities, it's really that 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. at night when there's this big spike and this big need for power. So I've been thinking about turning things off, turning off your hot water heater, not off, but lowering it. But the reverse is true too. So you, the middle of the night, you have areas where there's lots of wind power, and you have this huge amount of power. Well, you can turn things on, like charge your car, like heat your hot water, those kinds of things to optimize that renewable source of power.
Yeah. Let's, for a second, go back to the megawatts.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
I really like that. Because, you know, we're here for the building energy conference, and we keep talking about building efficiency, right? So, and all the codes, especially the Massachusetts stretch code, is gearing, you know, is really going towards more and more energy efficiency. So near terms, that could be described in megawatts, right? If you make buildings more efficient, you use less. So that would be a megawatt compared to a regular, you know, pre-code or code building.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Let me break down a little bit. So early days of, you know, energy efficiency, what people think about energy efficiency is more insulation, tighter windows, better building envelope, things like passive house and other standards like that to tighten your building envelope, which is great. Those are incredibly important, and they are sort of the first line of defense. It's like the first thing you need to do. They're not variable, you know, so that when I think about a virtual power plant, that piece of it, we can't change that on the fly. However, what I find really interesting is across the country you have these efficiency, I'm in Maine, Efficiency Maine Trust, and efficiency bodies and standards that give out grants and rebates, and a lot of them have been for things like insulating your home, right? What's really interesting now is that the trade organizations that govern efficiency are really moving to look at things like smart thermostats, smart hot water heaters, these sort of the next level of efficiency that can be managed in real time. And I think that's the distinction here, is what can be managed in real time to help with the ebb and flows of our power consumption. Yeah. The company that acquired me also acquired GE Lighting, and GE Lighting has always been an advisor to these organizations, which makes all the sense in the world, right? Light bulbs was the first, you know, incandescent bulbs to LEDs and so on. And so when they acquired us, working with these organizations was really interesting, because they realized that base load of the efficiency is one thing, and now we need to start thinking about the other parts of homes and buildings that both have a footprint to them, but also are an opportunity for this resiliency piece, mm-hmm. right? That we can really start to think about resiliency locally and then community-wide, right? And that's what I love about this work. I love the idea that individually we can take action and we can see results that effectively instantly impact ourselves, but that aggregated together, it impacts the community. And that's a really nice, you know, byproduct of what we're doing now.
Yeah, definitely. We all have to learn from each other, and we have to incorporate each other's practices. So if you want to give out an advice to all these designers and developers and architects out there, so what would you say, how do we incorporate more of the climate tech that you're talking about?
So what I'd say is that what I've seen a lot, and I've worked with a lot of architects and builders, and it's, first of all, just acknowledging that that we're at a turning point and that it's hard. Change is hard, right? And I've worked with people in the trades who've been doing the same thing for their entire career. 30 years, I've been installing the same kind of hot water heaters, right? The same is true, frankly, for people who work in the utility industry. I've worked with utility providers who are like, I've been doing the same job for 30 years, now I have to do it differently. And that's really hard, especially those of us who are later in our careers, right? It's like, wait a minute. But the technology that's out there, especially when you think about the basic ones like solar and storage, like these are well baked. This is not a technology problem, right? It's an education. It's a policy. To some extent, it's economic, as prices for, we've seen the steep decline of prices in solar. We're seeing it in battery. Designing this in now, or at least designing in the ability to grow a home into a resilient play or a building is really key. And so it's worth the time up front if you're not willing to commit to the investment in terms of, let's say, buying that battery or buying that smart load center now. I would encourage you to at least put the hooks in so that that building, which you're building or you're designing, and you hope it lives in that space for the next 100 years, you want to make sure that you're future-proofing it, because we know what's on the horizon. We don't know, you know, the details, but we know that this is coming.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.